You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Harry Willis tōkulu anō mai, haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Thursday Wire for Thursday the 21st of December. Harry, your host is me. I am joined today by producers Ben and Lachlan. Hey.
Kia ora.
Last show of the year.
We'll be back next year.
Don't worry about it.
We will be back next year. Today, yes, is the last of the year. We're wrapping up some of the best moments from the Thursday Wire of 2017. We're recapping stories both political and cultural, some of what we are most proud of producing this year. He aha o whakaro, if you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we'd love to hear from you. Tuku pātui mai, send through a text to 5395 or wire mai. You can call the studio to chat with us. The number is 309-3879. Tukua tōpōte ki te pai te hau. Do not forget to vote in our Twitter polls on 95BFM News. What are our polls today, Lachlan?
Well, we've only got one poll.
Oh.
Slow day for the polls. Ben's, I haven't cracked the whip with Ben. What was your reaction to the government's medical cannabis bill? Do you think it's good? Do you think it's bad? Or have you got mixed feelings about it? Let us know. You know, send through a text also if you want to let us know about it, or even call up. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, we really, really would. Perfect.
Yeah,
sweet.
Perfect.
Let's get going.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
A few weeks ago, I spoke with my old mate and Seoul ACT MP David Seymour about Labour's policy to restrict the sale of farmland to offshore buyers. In the interview, I asked him if there was a danger that foreign owners who do not live and work on the land would be less concerned with protecting the environment and other regulations than someone who lives in New Zealand and works the land themselves. David took objection to this and let me know it. So, you know, have a listen and text in and see. Tell us what you think about it. Am I a racist?
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland, is now racially profiling.
Well, I'm not racially profiling.
Yes, you are.
I'm saying, David.
And the idea that somehow, you're trying to argue that because they live in a different place, they might not care about the land. You've got no evidence for that. You just made it up on the hoof. And I just think it's tragic that this sort of xenophobia has invaded the liberal bastion of BFM, which when I was at university at Auckland, used to actually stand up for freedom and tolerance.
Right. Well, moving on to assisted dying. So,
yes, I hope you'll be friendlier on this. Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Yeah, Lachlan.
That was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that
was really fun. Save yourself,
Lachlan. I love it being called a racist by David Seymour, of all people. Good lord.
Yeah. Why don't you text us in? Do you think Lachlan's a racist?
Yeah. Do you agree with David?
Do you think BFM still stands up for the same values it always has?
Mm. Have I ruined BFM?
Moving on. We're going back to the 20th of April. That week, Newsroom published a profile of E Tangata, a Māori and Pacifica online magazine. The article prompted a discussion around the lack of Māori and Pacifica voices in the mainstream media. And on the show that week, April 20th, then-host Jogai Batt chatted to Gary Wilson, one of the editors and founders of the magazine, about the need to elevate Māori and Pacifica voices in the New Zealand media. This and most of our interviews today are going to be extracts from original broadcasts, so if you do want to catch the full versions, head over to podcast page on 95BFM.com. But for now, over to Jogai.
The Best of E Tangata was recently published by Bridget Williams Books, and it cited E Tangata as providing some of the most incisive and profound commentary on life in New Zealand. Is this due in part because it draws on the thoughts and observations of people that don't necessarily receive the platform in mainstream media?
Well, I mean, it was kind of a flattering comment because, I mean, not all that we produce anyway is incisive and top quality. But yes, I think it stands out partly, or maybe even significantly, as you're suggesting, because as a rule, the mainstream media presents bugger all in that territory. I mean, it's not as if there isn't any focus on Maori and Pacific things, but there's no consistent coverage or sort of
mainstream coverage.
Yeah, thoughtful coverage in the mainstream. There's still much too much of a tendency to chase brown things when there's a potential controversy or misbehaviour or whatever. Mm. I mean, and I don't believe that that's, you know, particularly, there's anything particularly evil in the intentions there. It's just that for quite understandable historical reasons, mainstream media is still staffed by people who don't know too much about things Maori or things Pacific.
Has that reach kind of influenced then the decision to publish I Tangata in English?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things that we're really supportive of, and if we were bigger and stronger and, you know, had more steroids one way or another pumped into us, we would be hammering away at the need for much more effective promotion of Reo Māori. But we would be doing that in English because, you know, the most of the significant decision makers don't speak Māori. And, I mean, we've got an exception at the moment with Hekia Parata as the Minister of Education. But, you know, if we set her aside for the moment, there's almost nobody particularly visible who's a Māori speaker and who's influential in mainstream decisions. And so, you know, the debate, the forum for the discussion, the arguments and so forth really need to be carried on significantly in English. I mean, you know, hopefully they've carried on particularly strongly in Reo Māori as well. But, you know, we don't have the capacity to do that, but more particularly, we don't believe that that's the most effective way to advance the argument. And I've got an Irish whakapapa, and I feel quite comfortable, partly, I suppose, because of that Irishness, to embrace the idea that the most effective way to advance Reo Māori is through Reo Pākehā.
I see. Well, it kind of sounds like you've described this air of exclusivity maybe that is quite common with independent media platforms. Is I Tangata just for Māori and Pacifica peoples, or is this another misconception, if you will?
Well, it could be, but what we're really aiming for, and we don't know how far down the track that is, but the Māori and Pacific thing is just, you know, we see it, Tapu and I particularly, and Stacey and Morrison and Dale Husband and the others, Moana Maniapoto, in the sort of inner circle of ET. We really see that the, you know, Māori particularly is the first step that we need to take, but right back in 1980 when we started doing the introductory courses, we combine that with, you know, Pacific interests as well. And so that's been, for us, quite a comfortable and sensible and workable and productive combo. Mm. But what we're really looking forward towards is what we would hope a professional mainstream media system would be providing, is that is expertise, you know, covering the whole of New Zealand society. And, you know, so that there's, you know, you know, we're pushing in a sense through the media for social justice. And so that means trying to deal with the injustice that affects not just Māori, although that's considerable, and not just Samoans and Tongans and so forth, but although that's considerable, but Chinese and Indian and Fijian and Somalis and so forth. You know, the difficulty is that the New Zealand, or among the significant difficulties, are that the education system has been very narrow and white, and unfortunately, but I suppose inevitably, the media system has, you know, has just followed on and been very narrow and white. And we're just trying to do what we can to broaden that coverage and broaden that commitment and broaden the efforts to try and make New Zealanders, New Zealand, you know, much more inclusive society, actually inclusive society.
Why is it so important to uplift Māori and Pacifica voices in the media?
Well, the media is there, you know, has a number of roles, but one role, a reasonable role, I think, is to reflect New Zealand society back to itself, but also to provide enough information that that society then can make intelligent decisions about how it should go. And if the media doesn't have, you know, sufficient knowledge or expertise or commitment to look closely at the situation, the pluses and minuses in Maori worlds and in PI worlds, well, it can't deliver that, and so that's a significant failing, and a costly failing too, not just for the Maori and Pacifica, but also costly for Pākehā and any other tauiwi who, you know, New Zealand, because they miss out on that Polynesian richness. I mean, we're here in that, you know, in a Polynesian country, and yet the, you know, we're in situations where almost inevitably Pākehā grow up ignorant, or pretty ignorant of those other worlds, and that's a cost to them, I believe, cost to all of us.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
Hello, yes, this is The Wire. You were enjoying some ice cream here. I believe Harry's got mango. How is it, Harry?
I've got mango. It's dairy-free,
How's your mint BFM chocolate?
It's quite creamy.
Ben's eating his with a knife, I might point out, because he refuses to use the little wooden stick that comes with it.
Well, there weren't any spoons. I don't know why you have to tell
people. You can use a wooden stick. Anyway.
Just little things on the last day.
Maybe I'm allergic to wood, Lachlan.
You were chewing on wood the other day. Anyway.
Well, not like that.
Moving on with the show.
October, 5th of October, I did an interview with People Against Prisons Aotearoa. I spoke with Emi Rakete from People Against Prisons after it came out that they were being wiretapped by police. This was revealed in court documents during their trial for trespass. And that's when they were first made aware that they were being tapped. So here's that interview with Emi.
Last week, three organisers with People Against Prisons Aotearoa were in court on trespass charges. So last year, these members of the organisation occupied a Department of Corrections office in Hamilton to protest a very mentally ill transgender prisoner who we've been working with being placed into solitary confinement. All the international research shows that solitary confinement is extremely bad for you, not just physically but mentally. It's closely associated with suicides in prison, so knowing that this woman was in imminent danger from the conditions that Corrections was putting her in, we decided to have this sit-in protest at a Corrections office. And so they were arrested, and what we found out yesterday when they were in court is that the police then tapped their phones.
Why do you feel they chose to tap the phones of the organisers?
So the role of police, not just in this country but around the world really, is to suppress any resistance to the government and the interests of the wealthy classes. And we see this even going back to like Parihaka in this country. It was the police who threw the people out of Parihaka and into prison so that their land could be sold to settlers. And what we're seeing here is fundamentally the same thing, where the police is acting in defence of the class interests of the rich and in the interests of the government. And so this was an explicitly political attack on an organisation by the New Zealand Police.
So do you feel this was more an intimidation tactic on People Against Prisons Aotearoa rather than they had legitimate concerns about your organising and felt it was possibly dangerous?
Yeah, absolutely. This was a completely non-violent protest. They literally walked in, chained themselves to a desk and then sat there demanding that this woman was removed from life-threatening conditions. Nobody was harmed. Nobody was ever at risk of being harmed. The Search and Surveillance Act, which we believe the surveillance was conducted under, says that this kind of surveillance can only be used against people who are accused of a crime where the prison sentence is 7 years or more. And this was a simple trespass case. All of the charges, all of the people who are in court were discharged without conviction. So it was an incredibly, incredibly minor crime, if we even want to call it that. So it absolutely does not warrant this level of surveillance by the police. The only reason that the surveillance was conducted was to try to limit our organization's ability to organize. And, you know, that didn't happen. We continue and, you know, will continue to do our work. But the fact that the New Zealand Police is engaging in this kind of surveillance against people who have political beliefs that are inconvenient to the government, I think is a really, really dangerous standard to be setting that I think everyone should be really worried about and really angry about.
What sort of implications do you believe the police's ability to tap phones has for organisations like yours?
I mean, we saw 10 years ago with Operation 8 and the terror raids, so-called terror raids that were launched around this country at non-violent Māori activists, and left-wing political organisations that the New Zealand government and the New Zealand police are very willing to use surveillance to create vast conspiracies that do not exist in an effort to drag people through the courts and dismantle political organisations that they don't like. If they are gearing up to do that again, I think everyone should be extremely concerned about it. We saw in the last few months that Greenpeace were being tailed. There's obviously been an immense extension of the kinds of surveillance powers that were misused 10 years ago to try to create the Operation 8 raids. And I think nobody should be pleased to see that that could happen again and that there's no reason it couldn't happen again.
What? Ooh, sorry about that last one. I also spoke with AUT law lecturer Kylie Quince about surveillance more generally in Aotearoa.
The point is that it is a crime for anyone, any citizen, police included, to intercept private communications between citizens with a surveillance device. So that is an offence under our Crimes Act, which means that the police or any other citizen or any law enforcement authority, if they want to intercept private communications or to surveil a citizen in any way that involves a device, whether that be an interception device, a tracking device, for example, that you might attach to someone's car or other property, must be done pursuant to a surveillance device warrant under the Search and Surveillance Act 2012. So in New Zealand, we had a significant overhaul of our search and surveillance laws 5 years ago. That's currently under review by the Law Commission. Because the powers and the way in which law enforcement surveillance, search and surveillance is done in New Zealand were quite different under that Act, and so it's currently under review. So what happens is, so again, our basic starting point is that citizens have the right not to have their personal dignity, property, their personal communications with friends and family intercepted. So everyone has a reasonable expectation of privacy. And that's protected by the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act, so our freedom of speech and freedom of association, so not to have the state or law enforcement agencies intrude into our private lives. So that's what we're balancing here, the right of citizens not to have their lives unduly affected by state or police surveillance or search and seizure powers, with human rights obligations or our civil rights not to have our privacy and dignity unduly sort of interfered with. And so in order to do that, the police must obtain a surveillance device warrant if they're going to tap your phone, for example, which is what happened to the three people in the People Against Prisons Aotearoa case recently. And a judge has to listen to the application and can issue a surveillance device warrant on the basis that there are reasonable grounds to suspect that a relevant offence either has been committed already or is likely to be committed in the future. So that's the first thing. Is there a relevant, likely offence that has happened or will happen? And the second thing is that the there must be a connection, obviously, between the granting of the warrant and the allowing of surveillance and the likelihood that that surveillance is going to get evidence for the police to use. So one, is there a relevant offence? Two, is the granting of the surveillance likely to net them relevant evidence that can be used in a case? So they shouldn't do that lightly, is the issue. The issue in relation to the current case with the three young protesters, People Against Prisons Aotearoa, is that the warrant was granted on the day that they were arrested for a very, very low-level trespass offence. There are three young people who have, you know, trespassed against property, sure, chained themselves or handcuffed themselves to a desk. That is not a serious offence. Remember, I said that the warrant should only be given in relation to a relevant offence. Relevant offence is defined as an offence that is likely to or could result in 7 years of imprisonment or an offence under the Arms Act, so obviously serious offending involving firearms, or offences against under the Psychoactive Substances Act. So it's clearly that the warrant regime was intended only to apply in circumstances where the judge would see that it's being used to prevent or detect serious crime, so that surveillance is proportionate to the seriousness of suspected offending. Trespass is not in that category. So they'd committed a trespass. They had to then overcome the threshold of telling the judge, we think that there might be offending that is much, much more serious than trespass. to be honest, I don't know how they overcame that threshold.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
Ko te Wire, tēnei māranga BFM. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. If you have any thoughts to share about any of our stories today, do send your text through to 5395. We will be right back after this little break.
Hey, hey, hey. It's me, non-denominational Mistress Holiday. Having trouble deciding what to purchase your loved ones / relatives for your religious or non-religious giving festival? What about the gift of slow dive, the internet, Aldous Harding, and bad, not good? The gift of a rad time in a lovely park? Mistress Holiday says everyone wants laneway tickets. St. Jerome's Laneway Festival 2018, January 29, Auckland Anniversary Day, Albert Park Precinct. For tickets and the full lineup, go to lanewayfestival.co.nz.
All the way from Bean Blossom, Indiana, Reverend Patience Big Damn Band are coming for a super fun night of punk-fueled ragtime, folk, rural blues. If you want to win yourself tickets, just stay tuned to 95BFM all this week. It's that easy.
The devil's right here, doing very well, and it's hard to tell.
95BFM Border Radio presents Reverend Patience Big Damn Band, February 23rd at the Tuning Fork. Tickets from Ticketmaster.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
We're now going back to the 15th of June when I went down to Unitech to speak with the chief executive of Destination Trades, Christina Rogstad. She is in charge of their initiative, which is all about getting women more involved in the trades.
The first week, I wanted to test it out because it wasn't really me. And then I started liking it, starting to get up on the scaffolds and everything, and then thought roofing was me.
What is it about it do you like?
The heights are a bit iffy with me, the scaffolding, how it moves and everything. But then when you like potentially get on the roof and start working and everything, it's easy.
That was Kimberly Popata, a woman training with the Nailing It program by Destination Trades, a new company aimed at getting more Kiwi women into trades. She's looking at an internship as a commercial roofer thanks to the initiative, which takes advantage of the growing opportunities in the trades, and there are more and more women keen to get into it, chasing up to six-figure jobs. I chatted to Destination Trades Chief Executive Christina Rogstad at their new mobile site at the Manukau Institute of Technology Ōtara campus about her initiative and how women have everything to offer to the industry.
So Destination Trades is a company that's brand new. This is our first course. We started in late 2016 and we have a course that works just with women, and we assess, train, recruit, and place women into the construction, infrastructure, and manufacturing trades. We're the only company of its kind in New Zealand, probably in Australasia. There's a huge need for tradespeople, and traditionally 50% of the population being women have not been looked at to fill those jobs.
Why do you think women, it hasn't changed?
I think because women just haven't considered this as career jobs for themselves. They've thought more traditionally about hospitality, about childcare, about airline hostesses, and they haven't necessarily, when they've been driving by a construction site that has only men on it, said, gee, that's for me. Because there aren't many role models around. And what they see out there is primarily men doing these jobs.
So there's definitely a demand for women.
A demand for women.
And specifically, like, what do women have to bring?
Women have to bring a willingness to learn. They have to bring good work skills, so they show up on time, they're dependable, they operate safely, they're productive, all the things that other employees need to bring. So employers want people that want to be there and are willing to learn. So our women, in this course will learn some general skills, and from that they will choose what really appeals to them. So today you can see we're building a gazebo. The two gentlemen over there are from Girard Roofing, and they're here to work with our women to put a roof on the gazebo.
Is it equal amount of pay in it for women?
Absolutely, absolutely.
What sort of people can be earning in these trades?
Well, we know that, what Girard Roofing told us was that a good roofer, after being in the industry for a bit of time, can earn in excess of $100,000. A plumber will earn somewhere between $60,000 and $80,000. A builder will earn in the neighborhood of $50,000 to $70,000. So they're well-paying jobs.
Are there fears of, experiencing sexism? In the workplace?
There will be pockets of it.
Yeah.
You know, I think we find that anywhere, whether it's a corporate boardroom or a building site. But the reality is the women that have been going into trades have proven themselves to be very safe, very productive, very dependable. They don't have a tendency to feel bulletproof. They don't have a tendency to lose their driver's license. So they're really good workers. And industry, we have industry associations all the time that call us and say, we'd like to have more women working in our industries.
It's not that common for women to be in trade. Do you think that it's rolling their eyes or saying, not being so supportive of them?
No, I just think there hasn't been a vehicle for women to do this kind of thing. If you look at the group next door, there's one woman there. What our women tell us is, I want to learn and make rookie mistakes in an environment that's a women-only environment. I don't want to be the only one that can be laughed at. I want to make a mistake in a friendly atmosphere. That doesn't say that they won't know how to work in a male environment then, because we do talk a lot about that. And how do you deal with the fact that you might be the only woman on the building site when you get there? But right now, these women have built a community and a network. So if they have a really shitty day on the building site, they can call up and say, that was really bad. What do I do? And we're there to support them as well as the rest of them. But
absolutely, and also to have that safe space to learn the basics.
Yep.
Yeah.
And things, things that really point out that you're a rookie. How do I properly tie up an extension lead? Because you can look really smart by knowing how to do it, or you can look like a fumble bum because you're just kind of rolling it together and somebody says, that's how you roll up a rope, not an extension lead. What are the basic health and safety? I'm comfortable in my boots. I'm comfortable in my hard hat. I know when I should be using, protective gear. You don't have to tell me those things. I can anticipate what's coming next, so I'm not standing there flat-footed, not being productive. Because the last thing that you want is you don't want to go onto a building site and not know what to do. Things like, smoke was coming up at 11 o'clock. I'll just pop in and, pop on the jug. It's not because I'm a woman I'm doing that. It's because I'm actually probably on the lowest level working my way up as an apprentice. And you do those kinds of things.
But in terms of comparing it to the current prison system, though, would you say that it could be an improvement?
I mean, no, you have to even prove a piece of shit.
The Wire.
Hello, so time for my stuff. So this interview was done in the aftermath of London's Grenfell Tower fire, which I believe the final death count was around 70. If people have forgotten, that was when Tower in London caught fire.
People died, Harry.
Most likely because of this highly flammable cladding, which made the whole thing go up. Anyway, after this, concerns were raised in New Zealand about quality control standards. I believe the council found at least two buildings in Auckland had this pretty much the same sort of cladding. So for more, I spoke to Graham Burke from the Specialist Trade Contractors Federation.
Standards New Zealand actually have their own set of rules, and basically I think it's a maximum of 10 years they're meant to be reviewed. But they're really meant to be kept current, so they try and keep them up to date within 5 years. But there are a lot of standards that haven't been reviewed for well over 10 years, and some of them have become obsolete and should actually be removed. But there are other standards that are sitting there that actually need review that are still being used, but they're kind of outdated, and they're languishing for lack of funding.
So you mentioned funding. So is that the main reason for standards slipping?
Yes, I believe it is. There is high demand, but the model that standards are run under is actually a non-funded model from government, so all standard development is meant to be full cost recovery from whoever's developing them. So that may sound fair enough, but you know, industries actually provide people free of charge to do all the work, and the standards organisation basically does the editorial and management side of that. So, you know, for a small industry, just about every standard, just for a joint standard, the fees they're talking about are often well over $20,000. On top of that, you know, the participating organisations are flying people to Australia. Often owners of small businesses are giving up time, which they're incredibly short of, to actually do the development work, fly to Australia, participate in the meetings, and then Standards New Zealand then wants them to pay those costs. If it's a New Zealand standard only, those fees are usually well in excess of $100,000 each. Once again, the industry representatives have to pay all their own costs to participate, do all the actual work, and then Standards New Zealand owns the document and sells it back to those same people. What needs to happen is a law change so that the government will actually fund standards, because standards are there for the public good. The other thing that actually needs to happen, and it's every bit as important as the development and review of standards, is that the various regulators actually need to enforce them. And there has to be a means there to actually make sure that people who sell products that are supposedly up to New Zealand standards and aren't, there needs to be some serious penalties.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Retail giant The Warehouse was also in the news this year over a partnership with the government called the Red Shirts Community Program. People on unemployment benefits would work for free and would apparently gain vital skills for entering the paid workforce. What less positive about the program was First Union and its spokesperson, Maxine Gay.
At the end of last year, the government and the warehouse ran a pilot scheme, which we didn't know anything about. They never discussed this with us, where they had some long-term unemployed workers went to work at the warehouse for free for 3 weeks. And as a result of that experiment, the government announced that it was going to partner with the warehouse and up to 1,000 unemployed workers were going to be assigned to work at the warehouse for 3 weeks. They would not be paid. This would be part of their work experience. So the union, when we heard that announcement from the government and saw it being promoted on television, we were A, astounded, and B, horrified. We have over 3,000 workers at the warehouse who work permanent part-time shifts. Many of them want more hours. Some are as low as 5 hours guaranteed a week, and they kind of flex up. They get to work 25 hours. When they bring in unpaid workers at 40 hours a week for 3 weeks, our people don't get that extra hours. So you've got this entire system going round where people who are currently in permanent part-time work who want more hours can't get it. So they're struggling. Now, part of the new working poor that the warehouse itself is creating, because it's filling the gaps with unemployed workers who are working for free.
And so the government says this is about helping young people getting a foot on the ladder.
Well, that would be fine if they were paying them properly and not causing displacement among already employed workers. And what are you actually teaching young people like that? That because you're young, because you're unemployed, we've got the right to make you work for free. That's what they're telling them. What kind of learning is that? And furthermore, half of the time, we've actually just discovered there are, in a couple of provincial centres, people are going to be working from 10 p.m. till 6 a.m. Anyone who's ever worked nightfall knows that the team come together at the beginning of the night, they get assigned a particular area, and then you all work on your own. So there's no socialising going on there. There's no life skills and learning how to work with other people. You're simply taking goods out of boxes and putting them on shelves or tidying shelves in isolation from other people. What learning is going on then? And there's certainly no customer service learning going on. I think it's a disgraceful situation. It means that if you just do a simple calculation of 1,000 people times 40 hours a week times 3 weeks at even just using the minimum wage of $15.75, that's $1.89 million worth of work that the warehouse has been granted and not had to pay for, and yet the warehouse comes out and says it's not benefited financially from this. I just don't buy that. That's just an absolute nonsense. And this is a situation where you've got the state directly subsidising private enterprise. And at the same time, because people are so low paid, because the rostering system and the low wages mean that the majority of people who are working at the warehouse are either receiving accommodation supplements, working for families and work tax credits, the whole plethora, it's just mind-boggling, really, how much money, state money, is going into this private enterprise. If you're getting $1.89 million minimum worth of free labour, that's labour you haven't had to pay for, then of course they're benefiting financially from that. So I think it's time for the warehouse to come clean, the government to stop hiding the genuine unemployed statistics. And I'd have less problem if people were being paid whatever the collective agreement rates were for the period that they were at the warehouse working. But it shouldn't be the state paying that. It should be the warehouse. Then it could claim to be doing some sort of genuine community service. If it receives people coming consigned to them by the state working for free, then it is simply benefiting from the taxpayers to run its for-profit enterprise.
So around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire. Going back to the 11th of May now, in my first Wire piece, I sat down with Alison Reed, K-Road alumnus and owner of secondhand clothing store Search and Destroy. We caught up in a cross street store to talk about K-Road gentrification of the area and changes to St. Kevin's Arcade over the past year.
So this shop has a very large history on K-Road, and I mean, apart from Vixen, this is probably the second longest secondhand shop in the area. It was in the arcade for 13 years. I've personally been in the arcade for 8 years. And probably the changes started happening when Murray sold the building, which would be probably exactly a year ago now. That's when the new owner came in and he started to renovate and make things look quite good. And we knew that his vision probably was more of a Ponsonby vision rather than a tatty K-Road vision. And that's understandable, and we respect the fact that he's a businessman and we didn't fit into his vision. Probably the way he went about telling us to get out, only giving us 30 days, was a bit shit. But we're lucky that we always had this storage area in Cross Street. So it was kind of a blessing in disguise for us. And in actual fact, since we've moved down to Cross Street, our business has grown a lot more. And we've been able to do things that we weren't able to do up in the arcade. Like, we do costume design now for theatre shows. So for me personally, it's nice to go back to my old roots of theatre.
Yeah.
But join it with clothing. So it's awesome. Turned out really good.
So it was that you were kicked out because someone said that it was because he drove the rent prices up.
No, but we never got an option. We simply got an email saying, please remove your fixtures and fittings within 30 days. And he's well within his rights because, you know, everybody at that point was on a month-to-month lease. Mm. So well within his rights. We held no grudge, nothing. He did what he was legally entitled to do.
So why was it that the previous owner sold? Was it
Murray? I don't know. That's a really good question. I don't know. Murray was great. He was.
Did you have a
really
good relationship with him?
Great. You know, he'd turn up with a bottle of wine on a Friday night and go, I've got this crazy idea. And he was a really fantastic landlord. I think the problem with the new landlord, maybe, is that this St. Kevin's Arcade was his first retail property. Although I don't know the history of the man, and we never actually officially met him, so I may be talking out of turn here, but yeah. His relationship was with the tenants was completely different to how Murray ran things, where Murray would turn up with a bottle of wine. This guy, we never even met him, and that was after a year. Mm. And his dealings we weren't used to. 16 people turning up in a business suit looking at your shop.
Yeah.
It was kind of quite weird.
Because we saw on Trade Me, he's posted recently, like this weekend, an ad for more spaces. And in the description is we want more well-heeled people.
And good luck to him. Yeah. Good luck to him. Like, it makes me laugh. Mm. What was probably disappointing for us is we had this great community. We had the vegan shop. We had Metro next door to us. You know, we had a great group of different retail businesses that worked together really well. And that was the most sad thing when we left, is suddenly our community was gone. The good news is that everybody who was kicked out has found a life elsewhere, naturally you would, and is doing really well.
That's cool.
So nobody is, you know, crying over spilt milk or anything, because we've actually done better. I don't know. It's the problem with K Road and well-heeled shops. There's no parking.
Yeah.
I don't think the infrastructure lends itself well to having Newmarket or Ponsonby type shops up there. And there's still an element of risk/danger with, you know, the bars being around. And it can be dangerous at times. And there are, you know, after a certain time at night, it does get quite rough.
Mm.
So there's all of that that's sort of got to be sorted before.
I mean, what do you think about all of the new places up K Road, even up there's that new collective down the road? It's just because a lot of people are using the word gentrification, which I guess is accurate.
It's accurate.
Do you think it's negative?
No, I don't think it's negative. I don't think it's negative. I just feel sad for the loss of community, which I feel has gone.
Right.
So, you know, luckily we still get people coming down here just to hang out and have a cup of tea, and they can do some art if they want. And we've hosted artists in here. That's kind of gone. There doesn't seem to be a hub, per se, which or a collective.
Do you think St. Kevin's Arcade was that?
It definitely was that. And, you know, down the other end it's Coco's. And a lot of people, it was a meeting point. And now it's just a little bit cold and stark. So, I don't know, maybe there's a new meeting point, I'm not sure, but lots of people come up down here and hang out. I don't know, I mean, it can't be a bad thing. I don't know if I've got an opinion on it. I've never been to the new collective place, only because I'd go to Coco's first. But then I'm loyal, and
we
so...
love Coco's. Yeah, I was wondering, what's the general sort of, like, the feel amongst everyone? I mean, you've got people who are still loyal to you.
Of course, and we're lucky.
Come on down, what are people saying? Is it, I mean, I guess it's the same.
Again, I think the vibe is there's a loss of the hub. And here's the thing, we're in the internet age, and, you know, people are on their computers and on their phones all the time, and I think that they miss the one-on-one human interaction. And when you have a shop, you're the face. And so people come in to talk about whatever, their problems, their mother, whatever. And it's nice to have a shop or someone or a hub where someone can just come and talk, and it's not on the screen all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's again what kind of St. Kevin's did. You could just turn up and sit on the table and have a chat. But the beginning of the end was the loss of Alleluia, because Alleluia really was the rock.
Yeah.
And it was the beginning of the end when Peter got bought out. So that's gone. We've got great memories, but there's no way of getting it back.
Do you think Bestie is, I mean, Bestie's obviously a very, very popular cafe. They do well. Do you think, I mean, they have the potential to strive to be something like that?
Well, Bestie is different, though. It's a new clientele. It's different. It's a great business. And it's got its own clientele of people. It's just not Alleluia.
Yeah.
It doesn't attract the artists, the grungy sort of artists. It's a different crowd. And I suppose it's exactly the way St. Kevin's Arcade is going.
I've read something about how a lot of artists are moving out of Auckland because it's just so unaffordable. Do you think that it's just becoming more and more difficult for retailers and small businesses, especially around this area, the central city?
No, but then that's up to us as small business to recognise the change and adapt our business to that change. And that's what makes a smart business person, I suppose.
It's fucked.
And we've
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Yeah, we're just going to take a little break right now, but we will be back very shortly on 95BFM.
The Christmas lights on Franklin Road are quite a sight, or so I'm told. But nothing can my heart envelop like the love that I've developed. My snow angels wide and go.
Oh, I'll be out in a minute.
No, I want to listen. Sing to me.
Well, as it's Christmas.
Give the gift of a new passion for photography this Christmas. ProGear, unparalleled quality at 3 Railway Street, Newmarket, or online at progear.co.nz.
All right, mate. Hey, come check out some of these beautiful tracks. I got 96KB MP3s. I got the sick WMA from Zippy Share, some great YouTube rips. Check this. Come on and wine.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
The Swap Meet. 4 till 7 every Sunday afternoon on BFM. It's a digger's selection of funk, soul, boogie, jazz, and whatever else is in the bag that week. With your hosts, Jupt, Kirk, Ira, and guests.
Lay back, take it easy.
The Swap Meet, Sundays from 4pm on 95BFM.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Given where our government is now, we're going to now finally today take you back to September 28th when I had a little chat with Labour Deputy Leader Calvin Davis. This was right in the middle of the negotiations between Labour and New Zealand First. So a little bit interesting in hindsight to have a little listen. We also touched a little bit on the first Labour Māori caucus meeting and Don Brash's comments. Stay tuned. How do you think Labour's chances are looking at this stage?
Oh, they're looking pretty good, you know, as good as the Nationals, I have to say. You know, MMP does this. It's no longer a first-past-the-post system where the party with the most votes on the night gets to form the government. If they, 54% of people voted for a change, and it's the MMP environment. So, we'll go into these negotiations in good faith, and we'll just have to see how it all pans out from there. And like I say, there's not really a lot that we can talk about in terms of the negotiations because they haven't started.
I mean, in terms of looking at policies that Labour have in common with New Zealand First, what do you think are potentially going to be talking points here?
Well, we've been going through both our policies and their policies, looking for alignment, and there are a number of things that we will align on. Certainly, forestry is one. I don't think forestry policy is really going to be the telling factor in any negotiations, and there'll be others as well. They wanted an increase in police numbers. We're looking at an increase in police numbers. Our numbers differ, but again, I doubt if we'll form the next government on the basis of police numbers. But we're just looking through our policies and their policies and seeing where they align. And each spokesperson has been asked to have a look through their portfolio roles. Well, I mean, there's obviously financial policies and economics. I guess they'll be important. It just depends, really. I mean, what sort of government do we want? What sort of country do we want? The issues that we'll be talking about, as you know, Labor's very strong on housing affordability and the homelessness situation, reducing poverty, education and health. And I'm sure there'll be areas there where we find common ground. But we won't really be discussing particular policies or negotiating on media calls. So, those are the values that we hold dear and the things we want to change, and we have to see how it pans out with New Zealand First.
Are there any major areas where Labour are willing to make some big compromises?
I won't be saying that sort of thing on the radio station now. I'm not sure. It's not until we really get together as a negotiating team that we'll work out, where we want to go and you know, that's all for part of the negotiations.
Is Labor still ruling out a position for Winston as finance minister?
Again, you know, I'm not going to tell you what we're ruling in and ruling out.
Okay.
And, you know, those discussions will happen in due course.
You're going to be utilising your own strong relationship with Peters here? I mean, how strong is your relationship with him?
Well, people keep saying, Calvin, you've got strong relationships with Winston. And, you know, I'm thinking, okay, well, what do people actually know? Winston and I are both from the north.
Right.
I've got immense respect for him. I obviously know Shane Jones and his team, and, you know, have good collegial relationships with other New Zealand First MPs. But, you know, whether that has an impact in negotiations or not, I don't know. But the most important thing is that we treat each other with respect and, you know, go in with an open mind.
Absolutely. Moving on, was it a bit unexpected, the losses of the Māori Party? I mean, was it a bit of a shock?
No, not really. The writing was on the cards in the 2014 election when we won 6 of the 7 Māori seats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Māori voters have spoken and their decision needs to be respected. You know, we went out to, we had a strategy. Part of our strategy was to go off the list at the time. Everyone criticised Andrew Little, saying that Andrew Little had told us to go off the list. Well, that's not true. It was our decision. He wasn't particularly happy, but you know, he texted me to say, well done, you know, your strategy worked. At the same time, there were two of us who were still on the list, myself and Tamati Coffey. And so the people in Wairakei still had a choice to actually give Labour the party vote and Te Ororoa the candidate vote, but they decided not to. They preferred Tamati. And, you know, people have got to respect that, and it's been quite disappointing to see some of the, basically the hatred from a small section of Māoridom and the Māori Party towards what the people, the Māori voters have decided they want. And we're really pleased to have 13 Māori MPs in our Labour caucus, 7 Māori seat winners and 6 others. And the big thing is to realise that these our caucus, we can say Māori MPs first or not, but we've also, you know, let's look at the skills they bring. We've got the Deputy Mayor of Wellington. We've got a District Councillor from the far north who's also a lawyer. We've got another lawyer with an amazing background in corporate law. We've got an early childhood business owner and, you know, runs an early childhood centres. We've got Tamati as a TV personality. You know, so we've got all this broad range of skills, which is just as important as the fact that we happen to be all Māori.
Don Brash did make some comments this week on the Māori seats. He went head-to-head with Willie Jackson on the AM show. How do you respond to his statements that he said that the Māori seats have outlived their usefulness?
Well, look, the Māori seats were foisted upon Māori back in the 1860s as a way to control Māori voting, make sure Māori didn't have too much influence. We've become quite fond of the Māori seats, and they've grown to 7 now, and now we have non-Māori again trying to control the way Māori vote. And well, how do I respond? I just respond by saying nothing, because I really don't care for his opinion. You know, I was in a debate with Don Brash about a month ago, where I told the story that's been retold up here in the north a number of times, that the Treaty of Waitangi is like a bridge between two banks of a river. The on one side of the river are Māori, on the other side were a Pākehā. And the question was, who's crossed over that bridge to the other side of the river the most? And it's been Māori. We've crossed over, we've learnt the language, we've learnt customs and everything. How many times have people from the other bank moved into the Māori world and know our language and customs and things like that?
Absolutely.
And I said, look, Don, we welcome you over onto our side. And would you like to come over to our side of the bank of the river, you know, cross over the bridge? And he just went quiet. Now, until we have a free flow of New Zealanders crossing that bridge and living in each other's world and knowing each other's language and customs and the way we do things, you know, Don Brash can just, you know, stick his opinions as far as I'm concerned. When he can walk comfortably in my world, as I can in his world, well, then we could maybe sit down and have that conversation. But until then, don't even bother, Don, because what he's wanting is for us to assimilate into his world and to put our world behind us. And that, you know, I just totally refuse to do that.
The Wire.
I don't know. And frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Yes. It's the Wire.
Well, that was our wrap-up wire. Wire.
That was our wrap-up wire.
Yeah. Should we talk about our wrap-up poll and then wrap-up?
Yep.
So what was your reaction to the government's medical cannabis bill, which I believe is you can smoke cannabis if
you're going to die
if you've got a terminal illness or something, I think. I don't know.
Yes.
Harry says yes. So 52% of you think it's good, 10% say it's bad, and 38% have mixed feelings. So, you know, overall I'd say it's probably got a bit of support there.
Had Connor M walk into the room.
He's also enjoying a Little Island ice cream,
which you can still available to win in the BFM prize pack, I believe.
Yeah. But for us,
that was The Wire.
That was The Wire.
Yeah.
The last Thursday Wire. Connor will be here with your last Wire of the year tomorrow.
Do you want to give us a prequel?
Any previews on what's happening tomorrow, Connor?
We're just going to be running best ofs like you've never seen before.
You have heard them before, but.
But happy holidays, everyone.
Yeah,
thanks for your text throughout the year.
Lachlan doesn't speak
to
me.
The two texts you sent through.
I don't get better, Lachlan.
Lachlan wants more texts next year.
Please. That can be your New Year's resolutions, people.
We will see all the rest of you in January. Thank you very much for listening in this year. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.